Hi everybody, this is Della from the Beauty of Play, and I'm super excited about this drop today because we're doing my very favorite science. If you don't know, before my homeschool life, I was a marine biologist, and so my field of study is science, and I'm excited, so let's jump in. So because science is easy for me, because that's my field of study, because it's all around us and we do it every day, it was actually harder for me to do this drop. It was a little, with other subjects that come a little harder, like history or whatever, I've had to do a lot of self-study more recently, and that has facilitated me being able to communicate to other people my process. But for science, I don't even really think of it consciously. It just kind of comes. So for this drop, I've had to sit down and think about what are the different aspects of science, how do I approach it, what we have done. And one of the exciting things about the whole thing is that I go through a lot of my photos from the homeschooling years, and I group them into a folder for science when I do these kind of podcasts or content drops. And looking through, I began to realize all the different things that we have done over the years. And I'm just going to give an overview today of our science in general, but it got me really excited because we've done a lot and there's a lot that you can do for science, and it's really an exciting subject. I mean, science is by far my favorite. Before I break down all the science, I want to bring my bias to this session. Well, as a scientist, one of my favorite things, one of the things that makes science so wonderful for me is the lab portion, that it's the reality, the going out into nature and seeing things, doing a demonstration and seeing the concept of diffusion or other scientific concepts. And so personally, I feel like science needs to have concrete demonstrations and experiments in them. And I'm beginning to realize that that's not the only way to teach science. My son is taking a college class, biology, which I was a little surprised that he decided to take that because we've already covered biology and pretty thoroughly. But his labs are online, and I'm just astounded that you can have online labs for a college biology class. So just know that is my bias. I tend to do a huge amount of concrete demonstrations and experiments and labs with my science. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. It doesn't have to be as many. One of the things about teaching science is that in that way is that it's very labor intensive. There's a lot of prep work. There's not only do you have to understand the concept of science that you're working with, but you have to gather all the materials. Sometimes you have to test to make sure that your demonstration or experiment is going to work. And then you have to actually conduct the experiment. Okay, with my bias aside, let's go through the different aspects of teaching science, the things that I think kids really need to know for science. There are different aspects. One are scientific concepts, right? Like respiration, photosynthesis, diffusion, osmosis. These would be like scientific concepts. The other would be the vernacular, the vocabulary. Science has a huge amount of vocabulary. The other aspect would be the scientific thinking or the scientific method. And this involves like making an observation, making a hypothesis based on prior knowledge and the observation that you've made, finding an experiment to test your hypothesis, deciding what measurements you want to take, analysis, and then making inferences from the analysis. And I'll go over that a little bit more in detail. And the other thing, my bias, my biggest bias, that I think needs to be included is demonstrations and experiments. And personally, I think those demonstration and experiments need to translate the science well. And what do I mean by that? Well, one of the things that I see often, and no judgment if you've done it, it's a lot of fun, we've done it too, it just doesn't translate well, is the vinegar baking soda volcano. Now, vinegar and baking soda is a chemical reaction. When we're putting those two chemicals together, we are breaking bonds apart and reestablishing bonds in a different way. And one of the reestablishment of bonds is carbon dioxide, which is a gas, which is why we see the bubbles. That is a very different scientific concept than volcanoes. Volcanoes do not work, for the most part, with chemical reactions. What they're working with are heat and pressure. And so if you're studying volcanoes, the baking soda vinegar demonstration doesn't really translate the science well because they're not the same thing. If you've been following me for a while, you know that I draw great inspiration from both the Waldorf and the Charlotte Mason pedagogies. And I'm going to talk about how both of those approach science. Charlotte Mason, for the early years, does the vast majority of science that I have seen, that I have come across, through nature study. And although I think nature study is a fabulous thing to integrate into your home, it's amazing. I don't think that alone is enough for science. But I also don't think that it takes too much to increase that to be an acceptable level. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. Waldorf for science does a more discovery method where you do several different demonstrations or experiments and then you talk about what you're seeing and they almost like play and then discover the scientific concept that you're studying at the time. And that is probably my favorite, in addition to the nature study aspect of science, that's my favorite way to approach science. Having said that, I don't think that that is the only way to approach science. And sometimes I think explicit instruction, where you're sitting down, you're reading resources, you're going over material, and analyzing, processing that material can be a very acceptable, if not a better way to go. Because with some demonstrations and some children, they will not understand that concept without the explicit instruction. Let's go back over the list that I was talking about earlier, the different aspects that comprise science. The first one that I talked about was scientific concepts. And I think you can use demonstration and experiments in conjunction. Like none of these stand alone. But when you're looking at scientific concepts, if you do the demonstration first, I feel like at some point you need to have explicit teaching. And that makes it maybe the easiest out of all of these different aspects, because we are going to get this information from other sources, from books, from videos, from curricula. And so sitting down and going over these concepts is important. And I'm going to talk about tools for remembering those concepts and teaching those concepts. processing and internalizing those concepts later. The next aspect of science is the vernacular, or the vocabulary for science. And I think this is a little more challenging because it's not just scientific concepts or things that we have connections to. The vocabulary in the scientific world is complex, sometimes complicated, and there's not anything that we have already in our minds that helps us to remember that. Really, the vocabulary in the beginning is kind of otherworldly, but we'll go into how to make those connections. I feel like with multiplication and with some scientific vocabulary, that both of those are the hardest portion of the memory to remember things. What I mean by this is if you are not familiar with the different kinds of memory, and here I'm referring mostly to the long-term memory, you have things like episodic memory where you're remembering an event, somatic memory where it's more general knowledge and facts, and procedural memory where you're like doing things and remembering the process of how to do it. And then you have all kinds of sensory memories that include visual, auditory, and tactile experiences. And the thing about multiplication and division, and in my opinion, when you're first starting with scientific vernacular, is that you're taking these things with no connection to what you already have or visual processing. Now, we can change those for both of those so that we are using narrative or visual memory to help us memorize those. And the reason that we would want to do that is because visual memory is one of the most effective memories that we have. It takes up a huge amount of our brain in processing, as opposed to auditory that is much smaller, and tactile, which is also much smaller. We also tend to process stories or narratives a little easier, making it a little easier to remember. And so when we can add those in to stories, that helps our memory work for that vocabulary. I do have things, suggestions, tips to make this a little easier. For one thing, there is a free group of cards that are Latin and Greek words for download that you can download and you can use with your children. They have visuals connected to the word, which is helpful. Also, I think it's really helpful when we're going through and reading sources that for scientific words, we pause and talk about the word, like photosynthesis. What does photo mean? Photo means light, and synthesis means to put together. So we're using light to put things together. When we pause and go over the words like that, it helps bring meaning. And one of the wonderful things I think about homeschooling is that for loads of homeschooling families, discussions about what you're learning and bringing things up later and making connections is so much easier because it's just a part of daily life. Sitting around the dinner table, talking about what you learned that day, anytime you're out and about in the world and something relative comes up, you talk about, oh, you remember we talked about X, Y, and Z when we were reading the book today, or we read about that last week. Those kind of stories and connections help us process memory, and I love that a lot of times that just happens naturally in the homeschooling life. We also use a game called Root Rummy, and in this game, there are two sets of Latin and Greek roots that you can play Go Fish, Match, or Rummy with, and they have a list of various games. We don't usually go to the highest level of game that they have. That's rather complex, but it sets a child up for understanding vocabulary, particularly scientific vocabulary. I'm not sure this is the biggest contributor to understanding vocabulary, but one of the things that I want to mention is that teaching Latin can also increase scientific vocabulary understanding. I did teach Latin to my oldest. We spent a good bit of time. We didn't do it until middle school in the late years, like 7th and 8th grade. We did some Latin, and then in high school, he did Latin Alive. And I asked him about his experience because I'm not sure that I'm going to do it with my daughter, who is 6 years younger than him. And he said that he thought the biggest advantage of learning Latin in that way was the science vocabulary. Again, I'm not sure how big a contribution that was. I think you could easily do it with the vocabulary cards that I was talking about, or Root Rummy, or even just stopping on scientific words and looking up the different aspects of the word and finding out what their individual meaning is. Let's go over the scientific method, because this scientific method and thinking is the heart of science. So the first step in scientific thinking is that you're making an observation. You're noticing stuff, right? And that observation leads you to wonder about something else. When you wonder about that something else, you can form a hypothesis. A hypothesis is a guess, but it's a guess based on information, prior knowledge, and other things that you know about that observation. The third step is to form an experiment. And there are several aspects of this experiment that are really important. One is to understand the variables, right? What is influencing whatever your observation is. These are called variables, and they're independent and dependent variables. The independent variables are the ones that we are controlling, right? So if we're doing a photosynthesis experiment, we want to see how much photosynthesis is occurring at different lights or different temperatures. Those independent variables are all the variables that we are controlling for that experiment, and all of those variables need to be the same. Otherwise, we don't know what is causing any changes that happen. So if we are going to look at different light, and I have this in my botany guide, and I think there's also a post that I will try to link for you on this experiment. It is a refined or adjusted experiment from E.O. Wilson's series on life. It's a high school free curricula, science curricula. Highly recommend it. It's free, but only on Apple. So if we are looking at the effects of light on photosynthesis, we are going to control every other aspect, every other variable that we possibly can in this experiment. And those variables will be things like temperature, salinity, or water types, types of leaves, etc. Everything needs to be the same. So we can't use spinach leaves for one and kale leaves for another and sweet gum leaves for another. All of those need to be the same in the experiment. We need to control our variables. Our independent variable is the variable that we are changing so we can see what variables responds to the change that we make. So our independent variable in the study of the rate of photosynthesis was the different lights that we were using. We were using a red light, a green light, a white light, and then we also had a control. And we're going to talk about the importance of the control, but the other variable is the dependent variable. The dependent variable is the change that we're looking for. What is changing when we alter our independent variable? For instance, when we alter our light source from white to red to green, what changes do we see? In this particular instance, our dependent variable is the leaf sections that we have made rising to the top, or the rate of photosynthesis. That's how we're measuring it in this experiment. Let's talk about the control. A control is set up in the same way that all the rest of the experiment is, except it gets no treatment whatsoever. So in this case, for our photosynthesis, our control was wrapped in tin foil so that no amount of light could get to those leaves. And what we found is that no photosynthesis happened when that happened. A control lets us know that when we're seeing a change in our experiment, it is the result of the treatment that we are doing, not of some unknown variable that we aren't seeing. Another factor of developing an experiment is that usually you have something that is measurable, almost always in science. When you're developing a scientific experiment, you have something that you're going to measure. In the instance of the photosynthesis lab that I was referring to, what we measured was the rate of photosynthesis. And we did this because the leaves that we punctured and put in the solution, when exposed to light, photosynthesis produces a gas. We had taken the gas out of those leaves through a suction with the syringe. They were at the bottom, and when we expose it to light, because photosynthesis causes a gas, and the leaves would fill with oxygen and float up to the top. How quickly they did that gave us the rate. So what we were measuring in this experiment was the amount of leaf disc that were floating to the top and the time that it took them to do that in. And the next step is to collect your data, to perform your experiment and to collect your data. So the important thing about this in science, and it's just kind of important for you to know and talk about with your child, is that in science, you have more than one replicate. So if we're doing this photosynthesis lab in seriousness, we wouldn't be exposing only one replicate to the white light, the red light, the green light, and so forth. We would have several replicates going at the same time. This gives us a more accurate measurement. It also helps light the control, let us know that our treatment is what is resulting in the difference or the change in our dependent variable that we're seeing. It also gives us data so that we can have an average, which is likely more precise and more accurate. So just a refresher on precision and accuracy. Precision is when you consistently get close to the same answer. And accuracy is when you get close to the real number or answer. And my favorite diagram of precision and accuracy are the targets. And in low accuracy, high precision, you have a lot of dots grouped all together, but nowhere near the bullseye. And when you have high accuracy and low precision, you have scattered dots all around the bullseye, but they're not together. When you have high accuracy and high precision, you have all kinds of dots in the center together in the bullseye. I'll link that visual for you in the blog post. The last step of the scientific method or scientific thinking, and this is one that I think we need to spend a lot more time on. I think the other aspects of science people get more easily, and this is the thing that's going to matter if you care about that kind of thing on the ACT and the SAT and college entrance exams. What they're looking for is they understand how science works and they can interpret graphs and make inferences from those graphs. Conclusion, draw conclusions. What does this point to? The last aspect on our list of teaching science is demonstration and experiments. And those are actually really different things, even though they get grouped together. I think it's important to distinguish the difference between the two, and I think both of them are really important to understanding science. In a demonstration, you are doing something that illustrates the science that you're talking about. One of my favorite and simplest demonstrations for convection is that you have a body of water, and we put hot water underneath as a heat source on one side and cold water or ice underneath as a cold source on the other side. underneath this tub of water, and then you very gently place dye into the water, and you can see the dye move. It goes from the hot area, rises up, pulls over to the cold area, and it starts a circulating system. This would be classified as a demonstration because we are showing convection. We're not performing an experiment. You could perform an experiment with convection. You could test like different temperatures of water. You could test different salinities of water. But what distinguishes that demonstration from an experiment is in an experiment, you are testing something. You are changing the variables, measuring the content, analyzing that kind of content, and coming up with some kind of conclusion. That makes the demonstration and the experiments different. And both are really important, but for a little different reasons. The demonstration helps us to give concrete examples to scientific concepts that are happening. The experiments illustrate the scientific method and scientific thinking for us. You can do both and even at the same time, but I think the demonstration should probably be done first, and then you can experiment with that scientific concept. Let's talk about some tools for teaching science. First, we have the vocabulary, which I've already talked about. You can use word games or visuals that help memorize the vocabulary. Also, discussions using the vernacular for the science you are studying is really important. The other aspect that I think is super useful for teaching science is illustration and narration, which goes back to Waldorf and Charlotte Mason pedagogies. Particularly with science, there's life cycles and scientific concepts and anatomy that having illustrations helps with all these things, diagrams that show what is happening. And one of the things that I've learned from illustration is to do the art and do it well, you have to pay attention. You have to study what you're doing. And this helps us to process the information that we're learning. And paired right with that is our narration, where we are having to explain or basically teach or express what is happening. And I really like to pair these things together in a spacing format. So the rhythm of our science blocks usually go demonstration, experiment, learning the concept on day one. On day two, we are doing an illustration of the concept that we learned. On day three, we're writing the narration, and there's this constant overlap between learning new material, doing the illustration of what we did the day before, and writing the narration of things that we did 2 days ago. And this does a few different things. This definitely helps us process the information, but it also provides spacing and memory recall. But it's scaffolded so that, especially with the illustration, by the time we go to write the narration, we have our illustration to rely on, to jog our memory about the process. Another tool for teaching that I really like for science are charts, graphs, or other kinds of visuals. There really are so many different kinds of charts, graphs, or diagrams. One that we used quite a bit in high school biology, which was new to me, we had learned it in history for something else, is a time sequence graph. I didn't know this until like middle school years of teaching my son. And in a time sequence graph, you have the sequence on the left-hand column and all the different components involved in the processes at the top. And the graph goes through cause and effect in the sequence that it happens going from top to bottom. I have a post on time sequence graphs with World War I that I did with my daughter that I will link in this post. And of course, the thing that I think is probably the most influential in teaching, tools for teaching science, would be the demonstrations and experiments. I want to talk about curricula just a little bit, and I say just a little bit because science comes easy to me. I don't have a lot of curricula for science. Some of my favorite source books, but they are teacher intensive, are Building Foundations in Scientific Understanding. I really like how these books are laid out. It's very much a play and discover kind of curricula. But it's guided play so the children can come to some conclusions about what they are playing or experimenting with. There are three volumes of this series, two for elementary, one for younger elementary, and one for later elementary, and then there's one for middle school. I really like how they start including critical thinking in the middle school years. I also use a lot of DK books, and some of the older books will have experiments, demonstrations in them. In addition to that, I've also used several Waldorf books for science, particularly for physics. I've seen a limited amount of how Blossom and Root does their science, and I like what I see for that curricula. I have not used it personally. The biggest thing that I think is important is that a scientific program have all of the aspects of teaching that I was talking about. It goes over the concepts, it does a good job on vernacular or vocabulary, goes through the scientific thinking and the scientific method, and it has a good variety of demonstrations and experiments. Let's go over some fun extras that I really enjoy in teaching science. One is some cards and games that we have. I particularly like Sibley's Birds cards. Sibley's Birds guidebook is my favorite book for identifying birds in the field. And they have a set of cards for North America that I really love. They probably have it for the world, but because we're in North America, that's the pack that we have. Also recently bought two botany card sets. One is 50 plants that heal, so it's medicinal herbs, and they are beautiful photographs on one side and then all kinds of different characteristics on the other side. What I do wish that they had added to these was the family for each of the cards. We also have a card deck called Shenlela's Quest Patterns in Plants card game. It goes along with a book called Botany in a Day, where it shows plant identification by families. And I absolutely love this because it goes through the distinguishing aspects of each of the families, and it does it in a way that it's easy to learn how to identify plants, or at least in the largest family groups. My absolute favorite, and I think everybody should go and get that app immediately, is the Merlin app for birds by Cornell University. That is just fabulous. It's for the world. They have all kinds of different bird packets for your region. It's free, and it helps do an easy photo ID, and now they have sound ID, which is fabulous. The next fun thing that you could add to your science journey is nature study, and there's all kinds of different ways to do this. Most of the time for Charlotte Mason, you're thinking of like making observations, looking things up, doing a short narration, and then some kind of art in a notebook, like a science notebook. And you can definitely do that. But I think that nature study can be a lot more than that. It can be just a concerted effort to take a field guide and go on a nature walk and see what's around you. Or even if you are stuck in the house for some reason, allergies, weather, etc., it can be a dedicated time to choose something to draw and write about, or even just something to look up. A lot of families don't vibe with the whole nature journaling thing, which is completely fine. Each family has their own personality. If that works for you, it's a fabulous way. We kept nature journals for a while. It's fun to keep firsts. if a whole nature journal is overwhelming for you, you can also do what's called a phenology wheel. And they have different kinds. So some of the wheels are split into 12 segments for a year. And you can just write something that you see in nature or draw it, look it up, talk about it, and place that tiny little drawing in that segment for the month. And you can also do monthly that's divided into 30, 32 segments so that you can draw for every day. This is also nice if you're like tracking temperatures or other weather aspects. It's just a fun visual way to do that. I've also seen in School Nest's planner, or I think it's Science book, that they have a graph for the month of 30 to 32 days, and you draw a color for each temperature the day. And you could do something similar for weather and even moon phases. You can use my perpetual calendar for that as well to watch the moon phases and then coordinate that with a phenology wheel of what else is happening in nature at that time. Another thing that you can do to encourage a culture of scientific curiosity is to have a nature collection. When you're out and about on your nature walks or just out in the world, you can find little trinkets and look those things up, learn about them, and keep a nature collection. Where we are, we're along the coast, so we keep things like shells, skeletons that we come across, or bones, different kind of lichens, dried mushrooms, crab molts and carapaces, or horseshoe crab molts and carapaces, silk moth cocoons after they've hatched, the molt of a cicada, those kind of thing. You can have a collection of nature items on a shelf or in a little box, and you can switch those out. The one thing that I will tell you, depending on the child, this can really get out of hand, and you have to be careful. So both of my children had their own nature collections. They were extensive when they were younger. My son has gone through and gotten rid of much of his nature collection, but he still has kept several things that are on shelves in his bedroom. My daughter would often collect things that had moisture in them, and we would go back and find, thankfully they were enclosed, but find, you know, maggots and moths and worms. And so you want to be careful when you go this route. The items need to be dried, and you need to make sure that, like, there are no bugs or infestations that are going to get in your house. My last two extras are probably my favorite. The first is classroom observations for things. And of course, my very favorite are butterflies. I love watching the butterfly life cycle. It's different for each one of those. I do have a post that goes over how to do butterflies that I will link for you. I used to recommend monarch butterflies because they're fast. You can just put the entire plant into the mesh surrounding and they stay on the plant, don't really wander off until they're ready to form a chrysalis. But lately they have had a problem with, one, migratory responses. So if they don't receive the right signals from nature, light, moisture, etc., they don't migrate, which is a problem if we are pushing a whole lot of monarch butterflies that don't have those signals out into the world because they compete with other resources and it decreases our monarch migration. But the second is they also have a parasite that has infected them called EO, and it causes deformities and deaths in some of the butterflies. It's kind of hard to mitigate that, so I don't suggest monarchs any longer, but any common butterfly in your region can be easily grown. You can buy kits, but the kits are somewhat unnatural. I prefer more natural settings. Now in our region, I suggest the black swallowtail for the same reason. It's a common plant that they grow on any of the parsley family, so parsley, fennel, and they also eat quickly, grow quickly, are easy to grow, and aren't too easily disturbed. Like some butterfly species are very temperamental, and if you move them or touch them, it often causes them to die. And black swallowtail caterpillars are not like that. They're pretty easy to grow. So that is one suggestion for classroom observation. And two are praying mantis, or ladybugs, or an ant farm. All of those kind of insect observations are fabulous to have in the classroom. One thing that I do encourage you to look for is to make sure that it's a reputable company selling native species. You can get praying mantis that are not native, but we don't want to be introducing non-native species to our areas. So ask them questions about the species that they have, whether it's native, whether it can be released outside without a problem, that kind of thing. Also love tadpoles, and they are a little more tricky, but really not much. If you have a container that holds water, they usually don't even really need a lot of aeration. But if you have a container that holds water, you can observe tadpoles. The thing about tadpoles, in the way that you want to set it up, is that once they morph into a frog, that they have land to go on. So you want to have a sloped area where there's water, and then they have an area that they can come onto dry land. And also for tadpoles, you need to have a cover, because once they make it to dry land, they can hop, and they will hop out of your container. And this has happened to me when I was a young woman and child, where the frogs will hop all over the house. Just make sure that you have some kind of netting or top of your container. And you also want to make sure that you can transfer those frogs back out into the wild when they metamorphize. You can also grow mosquitoes with your frogs so they have something to eat, but I think for most of us, we will be happier just transferring those frogs back into the wild. And the last extra that I think is very much worth mentioning is citizen scientist programs. And you can do a search on the website in your area and come up with different things that you can do. There are a couple that we have participated in over the years. One is the bird count. Audubon does an annual Christmas bird count that you can participate in. Another is a dip netting program that we did with a local nonprofit. They had different groups of people adopt a wetland, and then you went into your wetland with a dip net and other things that they gave you. They gave something to ID, like a mini field guide to ID the amphibians. That's what we were looking for with this, frogs, newts, etc., and tadpoles. So we were dip netting in that wetland that was our adopted wetland, and then recording information. We had to go, I think, 4 times a year. That was so much fun. And then also tagging monarch. There's a tagging program here locally where they go out and take the monarch butterflies off of their roost before daybreak when it's still chilly and they haven't started moving yet. And then they tag those monarchs and then re-release them. So those are some of the scientist citizen programs, and that's what you can search on your search engine, citizen scientist, and then your local area, and you should come up with several citizen scientist programs that you can do in your local area. Those are a fun thing to participate in for science. Okay, everybody, that was my overview of science and different things that you can do. I hope you enjoyed it, and I will talk to you next time. Happy homeschooling.